Welcome back, everyone. I am Bennett Tomlin, and I'm currently not joined by my partner in crime, Cass Piancy, but he should hopefully be joining us in just a little bit. We are joined by a very special guest today, James Seyfert, an ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. How are you doing today, James?
I'm good. How are you doing, Bennett?
Well, I'm doing quite well. The reason we're excited to have you on is because you live and breathe these ETFs and what's likely to happen with them. And there has been quite a bit of discussion and controversy over various Bitcoin ETFs in the crypto space. Can you give us a brief introduction into why you think the spot Bitcoin ETFs have regularly been rejected, but we have recently seen several futures-based ETFs get approved?
Yeah, so, I mean, we got to unpack a lot of things here. First of all, I'll just say, as you mentioned, I live and breathe these things. I'm an ETF analyst. We write Bloomberg Intelligence is Bloomberg's research arm. We write research about the asset management industry. I also cover a bit of crypto, and I have since 2017. So that puts me square in the middle of these spot Bitcoin ETFs or futures ETFs, really. So we had the Winklevoss try to launch an ETF back in 2013. That obviously didn't happen. So it's been a long time that people have been trying to launch a Bitcoin ETF. I mean, Bitcoin was under $100 back then. There's been a number of reasons why they were denied. We can dive into them. But first, I'll just explain what happened, why a Bitcoin futures ETF was approved in October. And that goes back to August of 2021. Gary Gensler, the SEC chairman, basically gave a speech and said, for all intents and purposes, that we are looking forward to the application of Bitcoin futures ETFs filed under the 1940 Act. Now, there's two ways to file for an ETF, really. You go under the 1933 and 1934 Act, which all ETFs are regulated. And then if you go a step further in the 40 Act, which is the open-end funds and things like that, there's more protections, if you will, for the investors. There's a board that manages the fund. There's just more restrictions, more requirements you have to fill out. And Gensler was basically saying, we like the 40 Act protections better. We think it affords better things for the end investors. So we'd like to see applications under this way. And to us, we were like, this is the SEC saying we're going to approve a futures ETF. And we basically wrote notes saying that this was going to happen. A lot of people disagreed with us because they've been very negative on Bitcoin. Fortunately, we were right because we stuck our necks out and they did approve the futures ETFs. But again, they kind of leaned on this whole thing of like, well, it's a 1940 Act product and not 1933. Now, to be clear, there were other futures products that tried to launch under the 33 and 34 Act. And it comes down to the way that the collateral to hold these futures, you use treasuries, and the way the treasuries are handled under these laws from the 1930s and 40s is they can either be seen as securities or not securities or diversifiers. And basically, depending on how you classify this, a futures fund could be a 40 Act fund or a 33 Act fund. Now, again, the 40 Act has a little more requirements, a little more things you have to do. So typically, issuers would much prefer just to launch a 33 Act product because it's easier to do. But again, so we saw a bunch of filings for 40 Act. They get approved in November. The big thing here is that there were already filings under the 33 Act for the futures product. So one huge thing they were leaning on was, we like the 40 Act, not the 33 Act. In April, we saw a 2-gram approval for a futures product that's listed under this 33 or 34 Act, which again, doesn't have those protections that the SEC was leaning on as a reason to deny these ETFs, and they went through and approved them.
You referenced the ETF I was going to bring up next, which was the 2-gram one, which was the futures-based one that ended up approved under the 1933 framework instead of the 1940 framework. That approval surprised me when I saw it because they had previously pushed so much towards the 1940s. And so instead going like under 1904B and under the 1933 Act to push for the 2-gram one surprised me. What I have struggled with since that approval is understanding why they're okay with a 33 Act futures-based ETF, but not a 33-based spot ETF. Do you have any thoughts on what's still preventing them from approving that type of product?
So the way I look at it from a high level is the SEC has essentially lost the forest for the trees, right? They're focused on minutia. They set a precedent in some of these denials way back even pre-2017. If you look at all of these letters, they keep saying they want a surveillance sharing agreement with a market of significant size. And that would include like, I don't know, Coinbase, Gemini. Actually, they might not even be classified as markets of significant size. So one, they're not really clear on exactly what a market of significant size. They're not very specific in what they're requiring. The whole thing is that they spent pages and pages with footnotes describing why they were approving this, but not approving spot Bitcoin ETFs. So think about that. So the SEC took time to put in literally, like, I'm talking paragraphs of footnotes under the reasons for approving Tucriam to explain why this isn't enough to approve a spot Bitcoin ETF. Footnote 46, I think, is the one that I've heard in reference most. The CME market, because it uses what's known as the Bitcoin reference rate, this is the crazy part to me. The way that Bitcoin futures are priced on CME, which is a regulated CFTC market for futures, is those prices is an aggregate of underlying spot markets that are the exact markets the SEC thinks can be manipulated. So they don't want to approve a spot Bitcoin ETF. They're approving a futures ETF, almost basically on a technicality, because technically it's surveilled by the CFTC. But again, those prices of those Bitcoin futures contracts are determined by the spot market that the SEC is basically saying, you need to convince us it can't be manipulated. There's a whole bunch of issues here. This approval of Tucriam, in my opinion, basically strengthens what Grayscale is likely to do. So Grayscale, Bitwise, they're due for a decision on their spot Bitcoin ETFs in early July. And I think July 6th is the Grayscale decision date, GBTC's conversion request. I can't see the SEC approving it at this point based on anything I'm reading. And if they are denied, Grayscale is likely to file what's known as an APA, Administrative Procedures Act lawsuit. And basically, without getting too wonky, it basically says you need to treat like situations alike. And Grayscale's opinion, which I fully agree with, is they're approving a fund, a product, that is using derivatives on an underlying market that they're saying this is okay for investors, which it's an inefficient vehicle, right? I mean, right now, if you're holding the futures ETFs, it's been okay because, well, one, Bitcoin has got demolished. So you get backwardation and contango, right? So typically this market's in contango. With the market getting hit so hard, it actually helped BITO, BITO, and these other ETFs to not underperform the spot market too much. I think it's 2.5% at this point. But I mean, would you sign up for anything where you know you're probably going to underperform the spot market by 2.5%, 5%, 10%, depending on what happens? At this point, if Grayscale's GBTC conversion is denied, I'd be shocked if they don't file a lawsuit against the SEC.
Can you talk a little bit about contango and some of the things that contribute to these derivatives and futures-based ETFs generally underperforming spot?
So when we look at ETFs more broadly, we've come up with a system we call the traffic light system at Bloomberg Intelligence. My colleague Eric Belchunas and I and Athanasios, there's a few of us, and the way we look at it is we don't view ETFs the way that, like, if you're familiar with the Morningstar fund rating system and other fund rating systems, it's like, this is a good investment manager, right? This is what I'm going to invest in. But that's not the way ETFs were created. ETFs were initially created as tools. Like, granted, yeah, you can probably buy the S&P 500 ETF and you'll be good to go for a longer term investment. But just because VXX, like, is available and your grandmother shouldn't be holding it, doesn't mean that it's not perfect for what somebody might be using. And VXX is a VIX product, right? So if you want to hedge your volatility risk and you want to buy VXX, yeah, over the long term, it's a terrible investment. But if you're using it tactically and efficiently, and there's plenty of ETFs out there that are built to do just that, you can't just quantify it as whether or not it's a good investment. So we came up with this traffic light system that basically warns you of any surprises. And any ETF that invests in commodities and rolls futures, we give a red light in our system that basically says, hold on, make sure you understand what you're investing in. Because if this thing goes into steep contango, which again just means, not again, I haven't explained it yet, but it basically, you're buying a contract, right? 1 month out or 2 months out that's going to expire in a month or 2 months. Typically, it's the front month, but most of these ETFs will mix a little bit in the second month to lower this contango, this roll yield cost or roll cost, as we say. Basically, you're buying the front month contract and you have to sell it before it expires and buy the next one. And when you're in contango, that means that the price of the next contract is higher than the current one you're selling. So in essence, when you're in contango, you're constantly selling lower and buying higher. And the difference between those two contracts on every month that you have to do that is loss. So if it's 1%, you're losing 1% every time you have to sell that. Typically, it's not that much. But there have been times where the contango roll costs, which granted, the market was more inefficient back then before it really got institutionalized, but it was like 30%. And also, granted, Bitcoin was up a couple hundred percent over that time period, but you don't want to be underperforming. It's just an inefficient way to get access to the market. It's efficient for traders. If you want to trade the market, these Bitcoin futures ETFs are probably very, very good. They trade with extremely tight spreads. The fees are not that high. And again, if you're trading, you don't care too much about the management fees of the fund. So basically, trading these things is probably way better than what most people are going to get on the regular spot exchanges, whether it's Coinbase or Gemini or whatever it is, because some of the fees and spreads that you're getting on there are crazy. But again, for long-term holding, futures ETFs really probably aren't the best.
Recently, you and one of your colleagues, Balkunas, wrote that you expect that the SEC is going to expand their regulatory framework for cryptocurrency exchanges. And once they've done that, you think it's much more likely that a spot ETF will be approved. Can you talk through what you expect that will require for cryptocurrency exchanges and what that will end up looking like?
Yeah, so there's a few things to unpack here. The one thing I would say is they want to basically expand the definition of an exchange. They say anything that is a communication protocol that allows for the transfer of securities or assets could be defined as an exchange in this new framework, which is extremely broad. Even under the current frameworks, if the SEC starts naming a bunch of these cryptos to be securities, all of a sudden these things are exchanges or ATSs, what's known as an alternative trading system. Those exchanges or ATSs have to report to the SEC. They would become surveilled markets by the SEC, and then all of a sudden we probably get these approvals. We don't know for sure that that's going to happen. Also, this rule, this exchange, this broadening of the definition of an exchange wasn't created for crypto. I mean, this thing was proposed, I think, initially back in 2017 to work on these requests for quote platforms, things with treasury markets, a lot of OTC type markets where things are trading on dark pools and things like that, that they want to bring under a little bit more surveillance. But what's going to happen is DeFi is going to get pulled in here. Because I mean, if DeFi, even if we take out exchanges, the main concern is people looking at these communication protocols, which is exactly what DeFi is trying to do, would fall under this. And then all of a sudden you have a decentralized network that's going to have to report to the SEC. So there's just a lot of like questions up in the air. And it's not necessarily going to be definitive that all these exchanges, when this rule expands, are going to have to register as an ATF or an exchange. But this is definitely going to give a little more leeway and power to the SEC to try and do that with these crypto exchanges.
Sorry, I'm late, guys. My cat is officially in the hospital now, so fingers crossed on that. But James, it's awesome to see you here.
Yeah,
thank you. But it's awesome to have you on. I guess as you talk about this regulatory framework that the SEC wants to put into place for DeFi or Bitcoin or for any of these, right? The Fifth Circuit just recently kind of put into place that the SEC is doing things wrong and that they have less judicial power than they think they do right now. Do you think that will affect any of what you're discussing right now?
I do know exactly what you're talking about. I won't pretend to be an expert in this situation. I'm not a lawyer by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess time will have to tell. And I honestly have to look into that more to see how that would impact the situation. One thing I'm actually writing a research note right now on this. I'm sure you guys are very much aware with FTX's proposal to the CFTC. Basically, they want to change the way that things are cleared and the way you can operate with margin. That's something I'm watching as a kind of a backdoor that could allow us to get a spot Bitcoin ETF. Basically, in this proposal, there's something under the Commodities Exchange Act. If there is any sort of transaction and you are offered margin, whether or not you take it, all of a sudden it falls under this category that's regulated by the Commodities Exchange Act, which puts those transactions under the purview of the CFTC. So it's possible that if this proposal from FTX goes through, all of a sudden FTX's US spot Bitcoin market could theoretically become a CFTC surveilled spot market. So that could be another way that we end up seeing somewhere down the line where, I mean, the other problem is that, as I mentioned earlier, you need a market of significant size. That's what the SEC keeps saying. So FTX US is definitely not that right now. But if other exchanges follow suit or follow this, it's possible. And then again, there was some very weird language the SEC uses to talk about the CME market, because they say the CME market itself is not a market of significant size, but they allow it because it's CFTC surveilled. So that's one of the reasons why they allowed the Bitcoin futures ETFs. So I'm thinking that possibly this CFTC proposal from FTX could be another backdoor into getting a spot Bitcoin ETF approved at some point down the line.
Do you think stuff like this Luna Terra fiasco, do you think that actually makes a difference for something? I think it's fair to say that really Bitcoin is totally different than that, truly. But do you think that plays a huge role in whether this stuff ends up getting a yes?
Bloomberg Intelligence hosted a market structure event, and I did a panel on Bitcoin or cryptocurrency market structure stuff. And this obviously came up as a big topic, and we talked about spot Bitcoin ETFs. Brett Harrison from FTX was on the panel. There was Brett Redfern, who used to run the Division of Trading and Markets, which is the division that is the one denying all these spot Bitcoin ETFs, was on the panel. So I got a lot of really good information, and we talked about this. I think Brett Redfern referred to it as gasoline for this fiasco. It's definitely going to be used as a scapegoat, whether by Congress, the SEC, whoever, to really go in and start regulating these markets in a more efficient way and really go after things. But I would take a step back and say, one, I think it definitely is. But obviously, if you talk to people at any level of government, they understand the differences here. Like Yellen spoke about the different types of stable coins. A year ago, that would have been stunning if she talked about like whether or not these out, she was talking about the difference between an algo stable coin and a USD backed or like an actual asset backed stable coin and all the different things. A year ago, if you told me she was talking about this, I would have been stunned. So I would say that for the most part, these people in government, they do know what they're talking about. They're not just like going in here flying blind. I mean, also the Luna Terra situation, it wasn't like it came completely out of left field. There were plenty of people that are very into the DeFi, crypto, blockchain world that were sounding the alarm bells about this thing being not safe. So I don't think it's going to really impact the spot Bitcoin ETF process. We could talk about whether things are securities or not. Most people, even the most ardent supporters, would say Bitcoin, they don't consider it to be a security under current regulation. I talked a bit before about whether or not things are named securities and they come under the exchange rule. I don't know how the SEC is going to do that. I mean, look at what's going on with Ripple. How long has Ripple been in the courts trying to decide whether or not it's a security? What are they going to do that with 100 different tokens? You almost need Congress to come in and decide what is a security or how we're going to regulate these things. I asked on my panel to all these guys, I said, do we need a whole new framework? The consensus answer is the best way would be if we had a new framework for handling these cryptocurrencies. But what's realistic is that's not going to happen. And honestly, all we need to do is keep working with the existing rules, even though they are 1930s Act laws and 1940 laws. There's enough stuff there to really get into the cryptocurrency world and create precedent for handling it. The next day at the conference, Ken Griffin actually said something that I loved. The question was, what is something you would like to like see happen right now at the SEC? And he said, I would love Gary Gensler to stop talking about regulating cryptocurrency and actually do it. I mean, if you look at his framework for what his goal was in like October of 2021, he put out this thing of like 50 some odd points of things that he wanted to do in regulating financial markets, and not a single one of those points was related to cryptocurrency or blockchain, which was crazy to me. Now we have Biden's executive order, and obviously a lot of stuff is going on in this front, so I have a feeling if he were to redo that, he'd add crypto and blockchain, but now he's asking for more money to do this. They've amped up their enforcement size. They're trying to hire more people to do more enforcement in the crypto space. Basically, the SEC is regulating through enforcement rather than offering regulatory clarity, which is what Ken Griffin really asked him to do. He wanted to provide some sort of regulatory clarity because right now he keeps saying, come in, talk to us, and we'll figure things out. And everybody who comes in and talks to them gets hit with a massive fine, which in some instances, it was obviously granted. They were doing things that probably were breaking securities laws or however you want to look at it. But for the most part, if you look at a lot of these companies, they want to be regulated. There's certainly plenty of bad apples and fraud in the space, but there's plenty of people coming to the SEC be like, please tell us what to do. And it's just not happening.
We had John Reed Stark on the show, former head of the SEC's Office of Internet Enforcement. And his opinion is that the SEC basically laid out in the Dow report and onward that most of these were securities and should be registered, and that these entities were just choosing to ignore that and continue to not register. Do you think there's any validity to that?
I mean, I'll just say it. I'm of the opinion I think Ripple was a security. No one has given me anything that makes me think otherwise. There's plenty of others that are probably securities. Obviously, the SEC would much prefer anything to be a security because Gary Gensler wants to get his hands on all these things. The SEC wants to be able to regulate them. I mean, Gary Gensler, he's a political, right? He's a political guy. And if he can come in and say that he regulated the Wild West of crypto, that automatically is a huge checkmark on his resume. That'll look good. So I think no matter what, from the SEC's point of view, of course that's going to be their point of view. Now, if you talk to the lawyers at any of these other places, they're going to say the opposite. The other side of this is there's so many things happening in the DeFi space where if you think about it from a step back, you're like, oh, that's kind of like an interest rate swap, or oh, that's kind of like whatever. But it's not. It's something somewhat different. But there's no precedent right now, so people can't say those things without opening themselves up to like litigation from the SEC, essentially. So there's just like this huge gray area in the middle of like understanding what's acceptable and what isn't, what technically needs to be regulated, what needs to be registered to security, or what. From anyone on that point of view, they're like, well, my sole point of view is that these are securities or that they should be registering as X, Y, or Z. And obviously, people aren't going to want to come in and register. It's a lot of money to do this and to deal with the SEC.
It's interesting you say that because I hear a lot of that. Please show us how we're going to be regulated. Please just tell us what we need to do. And then as soon as there's any kind of movement in the direction of actual regulation, they go, well, you can't do that. That's ridiculous. And I just wonder if it's a bit of a show, you know, like, yeah, we want the regulation. We want it. It sounds better than the alternative, which is we don't want regulation.
If you talk to like people at Voyager and BlockFi and these things, they want to be regulated. They're going into the SEC. They're dealing with the SEC. They're dealing with state, local enforcement, all these different things to try and basically make sure that their businesses are in line. But obviously there are plenty of examples like what you're talking about. Part of the problem is that it's all enforcement, right? So there people are coming in, they're getting fined, and then the SEC saying, all right, now if you want to come in, these are the steps you have to follow through those enforcement letters, rather than coming out initially and being like, these are what steps we want to see. But I also think part of that is because the SEC, they don't exactly know how to handle some of these things. So that's why Gensler's asking for more money to regulate crypto and blockchain, as he probably should.
Historically, hasn't most of the SEC's like regulatory frameworks or like regulatory tests or stuff at least come from enforcement actions? Like both Howey and Reeve were both enforcement actions that ended up being settled judicially that established like these tests to determine whether or not things had to be registered. That doesn't seem historically unusual for the SEC.
No, it definitely doesn't. It's a matter of what is the norm and what the SEC has done and is doing versus what most, like if you talk to pretty much anyone, they just would like to see more clarity in the space. Even institutions that are looking to get in the space want more clarity. I mean, Ken Griffin doesn't need to call on Gary Gensler to provide more regulatory clarity in the crypto space. He's doing just fine without the space. So I think you're 100% correct. Obviously, I mean, the Howey test, all those things that came through enforcement. I think we're going to get a lot of it through enforcement. I think just for the most part, people would just like to see the SEC, I don't want to say being friendly. I mean, they are a regulator. This is kind of what they're supposed to be doing, but they're definitely being antagonistic more than anything else. That's the way I view it. Obviously, maybe I'm a little biased because I read the stuff that's coming out and denying these spot Bitcoin ETFs, and they're just completely missing the mark. They say they're protecting investors, right? But you have over 800,000 people holding accounts that have GBTC. The thing is trading at a 30% discount. All the thing does is hold spot Bitcoin. People are getting access to Bitcoin via their phone on Coinbase, on Gemini, on FTX, on Voyager, anything you can think of. You can just open an account and buy it. People want to buy it under the SEC's framework. Like, just let people do it. And also, I mean, they're hurting anyone who's holding GBTC for the most part. They bought at XYZ level. Now it's trading 30% below what the value of the underlying holdings are.
Why do you suspect that is?
That they're not allowing the approval of GBTC to convert or ETF to approve?
Well, yeah, that, but also why it's trading at a 30% discount.
So GBTC was launched as a private trust. All these trusts, these Grayscale trusts, Bitwise trusts, they're launched as private trusts. And then the whole plan from Grayscale, from the very beginning, like we're talking 2015, they outlined in their plan that they were going to launch these trusts, they were going to list them OTC, and the ultimate goal was to convert them to ETFs. Now, all these trusts are structured as what's called a grantor trust. It's the underlying structure, legal structure of the product. GLD, IAU, SLV, these physical silver ETFs, these physical gold ETFs, they are also structured as grantor trusts. So basically, they're using a framework that they already know exists in the ETF space, and they're using a structure that they know they should be able to convert to an ETF. That has always been the goal, right? Now, we're going to get really in the weeds here. Basically, you can't operate a redemption program at the same time as you're operating an offering program. So they were offering shares of GBTC. then they got a cease and desist from the SEC actually saying you need to stop your redemption program because under Rule 144A, they can't be operating at the same time, which would basically make it like an ETF. So the reason an ETF is such a powerful tool is right now GBTC is like a closed-end fund, right? So we'll take a step back. So closed-end funds, they're basically like companies, except rather than making products like Apple makes the iPhone and AirPods, they invest. They have an IPO, they offer shares, and you're buying shares trading at a value on the market of what you believe the underlying is worth. Now, we know what the underlying is worth if all the underlying is trading, right? So what happens with the closed-end funds is you can have these massive discounts and premiums because people are, the shares of those closed-end funds are subject to supply and demand on the open market. So you get these massive discounts and premiums, which is what's happening with GBTC. Not to say that it's a closed-end fund, but it's like a closed-end fund because the shares are fixed. And if people don't want to buy GBTC, which one thing you talk about is the redemption window. The other thing is it's a 2% fee per annum. So I mean, even at 2%, you could wait 11 years. As long as this thing converts, eventually you'll end up out ahead, theoretically, if as long as the spot Bitcoin price doesn't deviate too much or fall too much. There's a lot of ifs, ands, or buts, but essentially, there's a lot of reasons that people don't want to hold this. Now we have spot Bitcoin ETFs in Canada. So I think GBTC was used by a lot of institutions. They then went to Canada because the spot Bitcoin ETFs were available up there. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why it might be trading at discount. Also, because people just don't think it's going to convert to an ETF anytime soon. All of a sudden, we see that this thing gets approved to convert at some point in the next month or two. You're going to see that discount window go very small. Like, and maybe it won't collapse completely, but it certainly won't be more than 5% discount at that point because people are going to arbitrage away the difference that they know they're going to get eventually when the thing can convert. Now, an ETF doesn't have these discounts and premiums as long as it's creation redemption program is operating. My boss, Eric Balchunas, likes to call the creation redemption mechanism the flux capacitor of the ETF world because essentially it's what makes everything go around, right? I talked about the closed-end fund. The shares are fixed, so they're subject to supply and demand. With an ETF, the shares are not fixed. So supply can rise or fall to meet demand. And the way that happens is through market makers in the open market. So if the price of the shares are different from the underlying value, basically, what happens is the ETF is made up of a portfolio, and you can always either exchange the underlying portfolio for shares of the ETF, or you can exchange shares of the ETF for the underlying portfolio. So those things are always like for like. So if they ever get disconnected, if I'm a market maker, I'm going to buy up all the underlying. If it's worth less than the actual ETF is trading, I'm going to hand them the shares, take the ETF shares, and I'm going to sell them, and I get that spread. So this happens on a day-to-day basis every single day. If there's creations or redemptions or any sort of trading, somebody's always in the market kind of making sure these things stay in line because if it deviates too far, anyone's going to take advantage of it. And we're talking basis points. So when that happens, especially in U.S. markets, U.S. equity markets, it's going to trade very tightly. So that's one reason why we're so bullish on the spot Bitcoin ETF because of the way that an ETF works. It's just such an efficient vehicle for pretty much anyone involved, whether you want to be a long-term holder, whether you want to be a trader, what have you. It's just a much better, more efficient vehicle for pretty much every single person involved.
Is this why you think it protects investors?
There's a lot of people that basically, like, we shouldn't allow people to invest in this because Bitcoin is risky or people don't understand what they're getting into, which I understood as an argument in 2017. But I mean, people know what Bitcoin is now at this point. People want to have exposure to it. If you want exposure to it, you probably already have exposure via one of those apps I was talking about. The other side of it is the way I view the markets. We have like 3x levered junior gold miner ETFs that are way more volatile than Bitcoin itself. Like these are highly levered companies. And then we have an ETF that offers 2x, 3x the daily return of those names. So like if you want to talk about risk, like those ETFs shouldn't exist either. And the way I view it is if you want to invest in something and you want to invest through the SEC's regulated framework, like these products are perfect. Even if you think Bitcoin is worth zero or you think it's worth, I don't know, $1,000 a coin, I'm still of the opinion that we should allow an ETF and let people make their own decisions. And not to mention, there's all these other less efficient options out there via the SEC's regulated framework, whether it's GBTC, whether it's the Bitcoin futures products, which have those roll yields that are negative. People are going to get access to the market. Like, well, I don't understand what we're talking about here. And then the other thing is they talk about they want a surveilled underlying market, right? They want surveillance agreements. So the whole surveillance agreements thing would be like Bitfinex and Coinbase and Binance or whoever shares their trading data with the exchange that's going to list this ETF, which one, no one's going to do that free out of their kindness of their heart. It's not cheap to do that. It would be nearly impossible to get it done. So that makes it very hard.
And we mentioned earlier in this episode before Cass got on that seems particularly striking when they are willing to list the futures ETF dependent on the same underlying markets, but charging an extra fee basically to investors to roll the derivatives. And then you have investors basically trying to invest in a business intelligence company nominally to try to get exposure to Bitcoin because there are a lack of better options. It does seem... It's hard for me to form a coherent argument as to why there shouldn't be a spot Bitcoin ETF, but people should be investing in MicroStrategy.
I'm 100% with you. It's just, this would be so much better for all involved. Even if you want to short Bitcoin, this would be a better way to do it as somebody in the regulated markets. When you open a regulated market, not that Virtu and Citadel and these other companies aren't already trading these markets, but these are the best, these are the most liquid markets in the world. Like we export liquidity to the rest of the world. Everyone comes to our ETF market, whether you're in Japan, Australia, no matter what, a lot of people come to the US to trade. It will make things more efficient. I mean, honestly, if you want to get your fingers into the crypto ecosystem, the crypto world, like opening an ETF and regulating that market and allowing market makers and authorized participants to get involved in that market in a bigger, more impactful way is one way to like stamp out any sort of like manipulation or fraud that we're talking about. The other thing, I lost my train of thought before, but I was talking about the surveillance agreements. If you listen to anything that Hester Peirce has written or said, like we're creating new requirements to launch an ETF that we've never had for other ETFs before. I mean, I would love to know what the surveillance agreements is for the small cap Vietnam market or some of these CDS markets which trade OTC. There's plenty of ETFs that have markets that are completely OTC traded. I mean, there's some sort of surveillance, but we're applying a higher standard to launch a Bitcoin ETF than pretty much anything else that I've seen. Now, you could argue, well, there's a lot of fraud, there's a lot of manipulation. That's what you hear from critics, essentially. But I just don't understand the process of applying so much requirement on the underlying market. Now, I think mainly that is due to the fact that the SEC set a precedent back in, I don't even know, 8 years ago that they wanted a surveillance agreement with a market of significant size. And if you look at every single ETF denial, that has been what they wanted. Gemini, the Winklevoss brothers, they got denied because one, their process never would have gotten approved. Basically, everything was going to be priced off of Gemini's trading, and they got denied because Gemini wasn't a market of significant size. Their application was never going to get through. I'm surprised that some of these other ones can't get through because even if you look at, I talked about the Bitcoin reference rate before for Bitcoin futures, it's based off of a whole bunch of underlying spot markets. And all these ETFs, they have the same thing. We're like, we're going to base our price of our ETF of the spot Bitcoins we hold on all these different markets and basically come up with an aggregated price. So somebody would have to manipulate like all of these exchanges at once to manipulate our pricing mechanism. Not to mention, they're going to be in-kind transactions. So like I talked about that creation redemption aspect. In the case of a Bitcoin ETF, you'd be getting shares of the ETF and you'd be handing Bitcoin. To manipulate the market, you're just going to be handing Bitcoin back and forth. So it's not, there's a whole bunch of different reasons that make this really questionable from the SEC's point of view. And I think it's just because they've set a precedent and backed themselves into a corner. They kind of have to stick to it.
Is there any other reason that cryptocurrency advocates want this so much other than it seems like an efficient way to open this up to retail further and traditional finance further? But is that the main driving force behind this? Is that why?
Yeah. So I know people that are huge crypto analysts or crypto believers that don't think we need an ETF, don't care about an ETF, don't want it virtually. They're basically saying you're centralizing Bitcoin ownership and we don't even want that to begin with. But for the most part, I think they missed the fact that I'm sure you guys have used the UX and UI on Bitcoin and other DeFi protocols, MetaMask. I mean, it is not, I mean, I like to consider myself fairly savvy. It's not easy to do. Like I'm surprised I haven't lost money or sent something to the wrong address when I'm playing around with this stuff, just trying to understand it. So one, not everyone's going to be able to do that. I mean, everyone keeps telling me eventually the UX, UI is going to be better. It's just going to be clicking a button here or there. I don't know how far away that is, but not everyone wants to do that, right? The other side of this is if you're an advisor, right? So advisors control $26 trillion in assets. If you look at advisor surveys on crypto, a lot of them are very interested, like the majority, and many have clients asking about it. And when they ask why they haven't invested, there's two reasons they give at the top. One, there's no regulatory clarity. They're uncertain what's going to happen. Is Bitcoin going to be deemed like some nefarious thing? Is the government going to ban it? So advisors are worried about that. The second thing, or sometimes the number one reason, is because there's no efficient vehicle for them to access it on their traditional financial rails. And they specifically say they want a spot Bitcoin ETF, or some will actually say they want a better way to tie into like the back end of like a crypto custody agent, whether it's Gemini or Coinbase or whoever it may be. But for the most part, they want a spot Bitcoin ETF and they want regulatory clarity. So all of a sudden, if the SEC approves a spot Bitcoin ETF, you get one of those. And then that's providing a lot of regulatory clarity, because then they're like, all right, the SEC has approved this thing. So it's my opinion that we'll see a lot of money pour into this ETF just from advisors. That no matter how you look at the way that Bitcoin has performed, if you look at it in a broad diversified portfolio, I'm sure there's people who disagree with this, but the number state, if you put like a 5% allocation, 1% allocation, and you constantly rebalance, it's been a very good portfolio diversifier. It increases your Sharpe ratio. It does plenty of positive things. And a lot of advisors have seen this and they want to get involved. So if you want to put 1% of like one of your clients' portfolio or 5% into Bitcoin or a basket of cryptocurrencies, you're not going to want to have to create a whole new like system for getting access to that. If you can get an ETF and just push a button and keep it in your brokerage system on the traditional financial rails, you're going to love that. The other side of this is for people who care about the cryptocurrency and obviously want the price to go up, number go up, right? That's what half this, I wish there was a little bit less of that in this industry, but that's obviously what it is. Cerulli Associates, who's another industry research team, they estimate there's about 26 trillion with US advisors. So, I mean, even if you take 30% of those advisors and then take 1% of their assets, you're talking about tens, hundreds of billions of dollars that will be flowing into crypto if an ETF is approved, because they're going to want to get some exposure. Now, maybe they'll use it tactically. I don't know how it'll change the underlying markets, but there's a lot of money still on the sidelines, especially if an ETF gets approved. So all the people who are anti-ETF but pro-crypto, you should think about $26 trillion that would likely be willing to put some money in here as a good portfolio diversifier. Obviously not all of them. It's not going to be that. I'm not talking trillions of dollars are going to flow in, but it's likely to be a significant amount of money.
So you mentioned before that you kind of feel like the SEC was backed themselves into a corner by making this comment earlier about surveillance agreements on the underlying markets of sufficient size. I think it's as much them pushing themselves into a corner, or is it that the thing they want right now, politically or for whatever other reason, is these surveillance agreements with these cryptocurrency exchanges, and they think the Bitcoin ETF, the Bitcoin spot ETF, is the political leverage they currently hold to try to like pressure these cryptocurrency exchanges to come to the table and talk about that?
So you're speaking my language. I literally wrote a note that said that the SEC and Gary Gensler were holding Bitcoin ETFs hostage. I think Gensler, like I said, I think he wants to be able to say he tamed the wild west of cryptocurrency. He wants to go after these exchanges. He wants to bring them under the SEC framework. Honestly, at this point, I think the CFTC is likely to become the market that regulates them. Time will tell. I mean, Bitcoin, as far as CFTC is concerned, is a commodity. So time will tell how much the SEC actually gets control of. But again, even commodity ETFs are regulated by the CFTC and the SEC because they're an ETF. So I 100% agree with that. Obviously, we had this theory we were calling the higher power theory. I don't know how true it is anymore, but essentially it was just that the higher ups didn't want this thing to go through. There's too much reasoning why we should just allow GBTC to be approved. There's too much reasoning on why it would just make sense to make this a regulated market, a regulated product under the SEC for them to keep denying it for all these. Like I said, they're losing the forest for the trees. They're focused on minutia and precedents, but I guess they're lawyers and that's how legal stuff works. But if you just take a step back, the better way to handle this for pretty much everyone involved would just be to approve an ETF and let GBTC convert. I mean, Grayscale wants this. All of their holders want it. Pretty much, I don't know anyone that agrees with the SEC at this point, aside from the fact that they've set this precedent and they're going to stick to it until it's met. And then to go back to the higher power theory thing, our whole idea was that basically the Elizabeth Warrens, the Janet Yellens, the Jerome Powell, these higher ups in government, especially Mnuchin back in the day, they were very against Bitcoin. So they weren't going to let this through pretty much no matter what. I don't know how much that is the case right now under this administration. It's very obvious that Gensler just wants to regulate and get his hands on everything, especially in the crypto world. I completely agree with you. Gensler just wants control to regulate.
Do you perceive that Clayton, was it that he was pro crypto or was he just ignoring it to the full extent?
He was anti-crypto.
But he didn't do anything, right? I mean, this is what I think is something you've often brought up, Bennett, is that a lot of things that Clayton possibly could have done during his tenure with the SEC to establish some regulations and knock down some of these bad actors. He did nothing. So I wonder what the reasoning is there. You know, I've heard he's anti-crypto, but it sure doesn't seem like he's anti-cryptocurrencies.
When Clayton was there, I know for a fact that Mnuchin and other people at the higher levels of the government were anti-crypto. So I think from above, he was just not allowed to do anything pro-crypto. But he really didn't do anything that anti-crypto aside from under his regime that he denied a bunch of spot Bitcoin and futures ETFs. I mean, he's talked at crypto conferences over the years, and he's decidedly, I don't want to say pro-crypto, but he's definitely not anti-crypto.
My opinion of Clayton, like, you can look at the Dow report that came out while he was head of the SEC, which basically said that the Dow token was pretty clearly a security. And he said in like 24 speeches after that, that basically every ICO looked like a security to him. But Jay Clayton in general was also not big on regulator enforcement or regulator action, like as a concept. And right. So I think that it was unlikely that we were going to see much of any regulatory action from him, regardless of what his thoughts on the actual things themselves were.
Yeah, I mean, even Gary Gensler said, I've seen interviews with him from back in the day before he even became an SEC chairman. His view was that when Ethereum launched, it was a security. He doesn't think it's a security anymore. He doesn't think it fits any of the tests now that would make it a security. But back when it ICO'd and when it launched, it was a security in his opinion. The only thing that really in the crypto space that I can think of that's definitively not a security in the way that it was launched is basically Bitcoin. But again, what are they going to do? I mean, look at how long has the Ripple case been going on? We talked about this before. There needs to be some sort of like, are they going to blanket name all these things securities and then spend 5 years in litigation with all these different tokens to try and determine whether or not it's security? Something else needs to happen, whether it's Congress stepping in or some other legal framework needs to be created, in my opinion, probably to do this, because I don't know how else they're going to do it without just flat out saying all of these securities.
It's reminiscent for me of two other markets that we've seen at least partially collapse. It doesn't mean that it all went to zero, but obviously the dot-com bubble, you had a bunch of kind of scammy garbage out there. Sure, the internet is filled with scammy garbage still to this day, and I wouldn't suggest otherwise, but I think a lot of the kind of institutional scammy garbage back then disappeared because the market collapsed. After that, we had the great financial crisis, 07, 08, and you have the housing market get ravaged because they were up to no good. So I think generally that's how you solve this stuff, right? Like the market does decide it. Regulators don't, as much as I think perhaps people like Bennett and I would prefer it that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of garbage out there. I mean, I told Kaz this, like I followed you guys because I've seen plenty of anti-crypto posts on Twitter of people that like some of the stuff I'm like, you have no idea what you're talking about. Like that is not even relevant. And you guys it was never the case with you guys. And especially like some of these white papers that come out from academics on the crypto space and Bitcoin. And I read them, I'm like, this is completely irrelevant. You're missing like key factual data points to reasons why like this happened or why Bitcoin fees were so high in 2017. And not once in this like 25 page paper about it was anything talking about the fact that there was multi-thousand dollar differences in Bitcoin prices. So people were willing to pay wherever the hell they could, as long as they were making a spread on those difference in prices. So Bitcoin fees were through the roof. So I just feel like there's a lot of specifically academia who the space is moving too quick and a lot of people just aren't keeping up. And also you have so many media personalities where, I mean, honestly, one of the things that the whole crypto ecosystem needs to do is stop being so antagonistic, stop being so, childish, if you will, at certain times. Like, yeah, like people are just so pumped up and cheering each other on. Even like some of the stuff, it's like, this is obviously very scammy. Like, this is obviously very bubblish. I don't know. There's not much you can do about it. I'm a believer. I love learning about Bitcoin and I'm trying to learn as much as I can about DeFi. So I wouldn't say I'm truly a critic, but I sometimes see stuff on Twitter and I'm like, I can't believe I agree with this guy on my investment thesis of this particular asset class or asset. It's like, I can't believe I'm on the same side of the trade. But then I see stuff, like I said, on the exact opposite side. And it's just like, all right, well, this person has absolutely no idea what they're talking about. There's a lot of critics that just literally don't understand anything about this. And I will commend you guys for not being that. So
thank you.
James, is there anything else you'd like to add? Like, I guess I don't like to ask for predictions. I don't like to talk about price necessarily. But Yeah, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
I'm definitively not allowed to give price predictions. For better or for worse. We're a research shop, but we're not allowed to give buy, sell, hold. But in my research, like, you can see exactly my thesis and my viewpoint on the situation. I'm watching very closely to see what happens with GBTC. I fully expect GBTC and Bitwise to be denied by the SEC in July. I will be shocked if they are not. And I fully expect Grayscale to file a lawsuit, an APA lawsuit violation against the SEC. I don't know what other recourse they have. They want to get this thing approved. They have 800,000 clients, roughly, that want to get out at par or do something with GBTC that they can't. So they need to do something. But then again, antagonizing your regulator is never a great idea. But they're kind of, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really know what other options they have. Obviously, the whatever conversations they're having with the SEC are not going well. The SEC has stuck their feet in and they're not moving on the situation. So obviously that'll be exciting to watch and see how it happens. The APA, you have to treat like situations alike. I don't understand how you can argue that from a high level, we're going to allow a derivatives product and in a more inefficient derivatives product. And you talk to anyone in the marketplace, market makers, issuers, traders, anything, and they all say that the spot Bitcoin ETF would be a more efficient vehicle and they're ready to handle it. So that's what I'll be watching. That could take years to play out. So my thesis is I think we'll get one in 2023, a spot Bitcoin ETF, that is, whether it's through stuff with the exchange rule. I talked about the CFTC proposal, which I'm writing a research note on now, could help things along, but time will tell. I mean, part of me wants to like put a percentage out there, but like, so we were very confident when we issued the percentage that I think we put 80% back in August that we thought a Bitcoin futures ETF was going to get approved. Now I just really don't know because there's so many moving parts right now with the spot Bitcoin ETF. I'm guessing 2023, just because it's been long enough as far as I'm concerned. So they keep chipping away at different reasons for denying the spot Bitcoin ETF. The last real bastion for denying is, like we talked about, surveillance agreements, the underlying spot market. No longer are they leaning on the 40 Act as a better proposal. No longer are they leaning on all these different things. The real last thing is surveillance of the underlying spot market. And so if somehow we get some spot markets like regulated by the CFTC, maybe that'll help. If the CME futures market becomes a massive market of significant size, which I'm not holding my breath, I don't think that'll happen, but that might help. But if multiple markets become federally regulated markets, we could see an ETF get approved in 2023. And that's what we're watching for.
Awesome. Okay. Well, it sounds like you're both bearish and bullish on this ETF at the same time. Bennett and I don't trade very much, so we're not as well versed in this stuff as you are. And yeah, we appreciate you giving us a thorough explanation of all of this.
Happy to do it. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Sweet.